How are you?
Not too bad. How are you doing? You look like you're in a basement somewhere.
I am. Yeah, this is my. So we've got a townhouse that is three layers, and we had two garages, and so we converted one of them into like a home office kind of spare bedroom sort of place. So that's where I am, at
Are there
least.
any windows to the outside world there, or?
Yes. Yeah. So we still have the garage door, and we've put in sliding glass doors behind the garage door. So I have that all closed now because otherwise when our neighbors drive by, it's like really distracting and noisy. So, but yeah, it's actually a really nice space. It's kind of a, I don't know, a retreat.
I guess it's quite traditional or old-fashioned in a way to have a basement in which your mad scientist works on their projects, or you've probably got a half reanimated body somewhere just out of shot, I suppose.
Yep. I'm not going to tell you where. No, but actually, most importantly, we have the wine rack is just outside this room, and the record player and all the records are in here. So, yeah, it's a good place to like not only work in the quiet, but then recuperate after the work.
I think it's important to have a space like that, really, that you can I kind of like the idea of a combined work and relaxing space that is personal to you. The room I'm in our house is sort of just set up as my office, but it's not big enough for a couch. Otherwise I would have a couch in here too, so I can, because sometimes when you're away from your screen and you're sitting down on the couch, that's when you're actually
Doing the
working.
work. Yeah. Yeah.
You're
100%.
thinking, and that's the big unspoken thing, isn't it, about some sort of creative or scientific life, is that you spend a lot of your time working when you're walking, or people think you're just staring into the distance and doing nothing, but you're actually processing and working on a symphony in your head.
Yeah, and I think that's where the most important stuff happens, actually. And it's the part that I think we don't give enough credit to. It like if we're not sitting down and like, cranking out 1,000 words or something, then it doesn't feel like proper work. But that's only the smallest part of it.
People often ask about process with me, and I'm always a bit nervous telling the truth because the truth is, I could spend literally months and I'm actually working feverishly on something, but there's no apparent sign of that. And that's very hard to explain to someone who's outside of that world, because they expect you to have, reams of notes and some sort of, huge board covered in post-it notes, like you're trying to solve a crime, but like maybe I do, but it's in here,
Yeah, no, I totally relate to that. Like I'm working on my second novel, and I've been working on it since, at some point in 2018. And I have written maybe, I don't know, maybe 50 words on it in the last 6 months. But it's there, and I've had some major like leaps and bounds in terms of my thinking and my planning for the next stage of writing. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard to kind of, yeah, like I'm writing, like I'm working on my novel, but I've only written 50 words, so.
No, that's right. And I mean, I've literally just passed that strange threshold where all of the thinking for the last sort of few years on my next novel has that seemed so disparate and unconnected. But I've had this hunch that maybe it was all part of something, but I couldn't see it. But I have enough sort of faith in the process now to know that, well, eventually maybe you will be able to see how the dots connect. And fairly recently, it's just all tumbled and fallen into place.
Oh, I love that.
And
That's
now I can
amazing.
completely see exactly what it is. And I was able to very quickly then sort of plot it all out and say, oh, right, now I know what it is. Oh, this is going to be. And so now I'm actually doing the part that most people would probably say is a chore, but which I find a joy, and that is the actual writing of it, because I haven't done any writing on it for the past 3 years, like 50 words. It's the same with me. I might have written, you know, a page or something of notes, but now I'm actually writing the thing. And but it's, yeah, people would be probably irritated to see the process, because, you know, you write a book and then everyone wants to know how you did it.
Yeah.
And it's a simple question, but at the same time, the most complex one to answer sometimes, because it's like someone saying to you, how does your brain work? Well, I mean, I don't know. I can try to explain to you, but how long do you have? You know, it's, mm-hmm. and is it really that interesting or compelling to hear that, you know, maybe to us, it might be to hear how someone else's brain works, but I'm always dreading that question if I'm at a writer's festival. In fact, I often will sidestep it. Yeah. So if someone, you know, is foolish enough at a festival to say, oh, Chris, you know, tell us how you wrote this book, I'll just avoid that question, because I don't find it compelling enough for the public to hear that, you know?
Yeah.
And also, there's probably that slight fear of being judged, as because I don't have an academic background, that somehow I'm not doing it right, you know? Mm-hmm. Even though I've just sort of found my own way of doing it that works for me, and there are a million ways to write a
million
book.
Ways, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I find that each time I write something different, it's like I'm starting all over again. Mm. It finds its own. It's like a child, and I only have one child, but I can imagine that the process with number two would be like, you'd be prepared for the difficulty more than the first time, but the child, like the individual themselves, drives so much of the patterns in that relationship that, like, you couldn't raise the second one precisely the same way you raised the first one. And I feel like that's exactly how it is with writing for me.
Well, I mean, I talked a lot when Mammoth came out about synthetic biology and cloning. That came up quite a bit because, you know, it's mentioned at the end of the book, and it was a nice, easy topic to broach in interviews. Because there's so much stuff going on in that field of science. Genuinely, Barbara Streisand is walking around with two clone dogs. They're clones of her dog that died a few years ago. You can, right now, if you have $100,000, you can go to South Korea, do a slightly discredited geneticist, and he will clone your pet and give you a litter of clone puppies that are exact copies. Now, it raises this sort of, raises a lot of questions, but one of the metaphysical ones really is, do Barbara Streisand's clone puppies have some sort of memory of when they were here before? Do they have a memory of chasing a ball in 2002.
Yeah.
Are they the same dog? They are exact genetic copies, but obviously they're raised slightly differently. Like you just said, you know, they're never going to have exactly the same environment. And for a dog, you think, oh, well, it's just a dog, so it's not going to make that much difference. Mm. Dogs like to chase sticks and eat food, and that's pretty much sleep, and that's it, you know. But how's that going to work when it comes to humans?
It would be a huge difference, because I mean, you have to think, in the cloning, you're taking the individual back to their first cells, right? So they're not going to have a brain yet, or they're not going to have little bits. And so you might even get changes with, like, some of the random chance things that happen as cells divide, or, you know, divide next to each other or bump into each other, or, you know, whatever. And so you'd end up with a completely different individual that maybe looked the same, but But is that what you want? Or do you like, I'm the owner of two Chihuahuas, for example, like they're all personality. That's the only reason people get Chihuahuas <That's right. laughs> because you want a dog that has a big personality. And like one of our Chihuahuas, we particularly love because he's so weird. And I don't think you could ever recreate that weirdness, no matter what you did, because it's just like a bunch of random paths in the forest that, you know, right. he's taken to get to this weirdness right. that he has today.
And so the example I think of, when it comes to human cloning, which will absolutely happen whether we object to it or not, and perhaps already has, is that if you're going to clone, it's never going to be, you know, your eye who get cloned. It's going to be the fabulously wealthy.
Like Elon Musk, for example.
Yeah. Donald Trump. People on earth that you want to be cloned will get cloned, and Trump will run again for president in 2076.
Imagine that.
Or his clone, who could be worse. But if it's the wealthy, the extraordinary wealthy who are going to be cloned, chances are they'll still be alive when the clone is born. So will they raise the clone? Will they be raising a version of themselves, trying to, you know, mimic their upbringing as closely as possible so that individual turns out the same as them? Would that clone rebel against that and say, well, I don't want to be like you? If you cloned Michael Jackson, would the new Michael Jackson be a bus driver or a singer?
Mm-hmm.
How much, you know, this whole thing about human cloning will probably be about control and, you know, people perpetuating their lives. But they'll quickly lose control of it, whether they like it or not, because they won't own that individual. Or at least I hope not.
Yeah.
but they can't ever, you know, own the individual's mind, you know, even if they may own them in some sort of weird contractual arrangement where you can't ultimately own what's inside someone's head. And so they'll have a mind of their own as a fully formed individual. You'd imagine if it was you in their position, you'd be like, wait a minute, I'm a clone of this guy. I hate him. I don't want to
yeah.
be. I can't believe this has happened to me. And you'd probably go the complete opposite way to that person.
I feel like it would be a more difficult version of the parent-child relationship that you have to, like, at some stage, I mean, my daughter is 14 and a half now, and at some stage, it's like you've put all of these things into play in this 14 and a half years that we've been together, like, you know, the things we've talked about and sort of all of the times that we've, you know, sort of reenacted situations and talked about, you know, what happens. But at some point, like, she's got to make her own decisions. Like, she's got to look both ways before she crosses the road, right? I can't stand there and do that for her. And I've got to let her be the person that she's going to be. And I've, you know, done my best to help her be that best version of herself. But I can only imagine the pressure if you're, like, raising a version of yourself and you want to make that a better version of you. And then at some point having to realize, like, I have to let this person go and do what they're going to do, or else keep them in a box in my, like, renovated garage.
It's the ultimate narcissism, isn't it, though?
And it
will be people like Musk or Bezos, or who actually the first people to do this kind of thing, or, you know, fabulously wealthy politicians or royalty or whatever. All these people, and we really don't need the current version of them, let alone an army of clones of them. My God.
No, I know. Well, I should probably, I mean, this has been like a really interesting chat to start off with. And if you're cool with it, then I think we should just keep it at the start of the podcast.
Let's just segue into the intro.
Yeah. And I will now introduce this voice that you've all been hearing, which is Chris Flynn, who's the author of three novels, the most recent of which, Mammoth, was shortlisted for the Indie Book Awards and the Russell Prize for Humor. His work has appeared in The Age, The Australian, The Guardian, McSweeney's, The Paris Review, and many other enviable publications. He's editor in residence at Museums Victoria and is the author of a series of picture books for children about Horridus, Melbourne Museum's Triceratops, which we're going to be talking a bit about today. These books are Horridus and the Hidden Valley and the forthcoming Horridus and the Night Forest. He is also the editor of a coffee table book chronicling the acquisition and display of the dinosaur, which is called Horridus, Journey of a Triceratops. Chris lives on Millel or Phillip Island. Welcome.
Hello, hello, hello. We've already talked, but
I know.
I kind of like the in media res beginning of, you know, where you just start talking and then you introduce the person 15 minutes in. I like that.
That's right. It's like there, we have no stereotypes about who this is. We have no idea. Boom, it's Chris Flynn. We'll have to give a prize for people who can guess it straight up.
I guess there's not many people with my accent in the literary world in Australia. So
where do you come from originally?
Oh, I'm from Belfast originally in Ireland, but I left there when I was 18. Mm-hmm. And lived in France for a couple of years, didn't speak English for a few years, and sort of slowly in my 20s found my way to Australia. So I've been here for 23 years, I suppose. I just turned 50 recently, so
excellent.
I still haven't lost the accent, but people seem to, for some reason, I don't know why, like it.
Yeah, no, I have. So I've been in Australia for 18 years. I moved here from the US, and I now have that thing, and I don't know if it happens as much with the Irish accent, but where when I go back to the States, people love my Australian accent, but when I'm here, Australians are like, you're so American.
you don't sound too American. You do sound like, if I had to guess, I would say you're an American who's been here for a while.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. So Chris, is this actually the second time that we've interviewed you for Science Right Now? The first time was around the time Mammoth came out, when we had you on with James Bradley and Donna Mazza to talk about extinction and de-extinction and talking mammoths. You've been very busy since then, particularly in relation to this collaboration with Museums Victoria. And I'd love to hear a bit more about your work with the Triceratops there.
So this is a very strange twist in my tale. Mammoth came out 2020, sort of at the start of the pandemic. And partly, I think, because people were reading a lot more, they were stuck at home. Partly because it was an odd sort of proposition that appealed to a certain audience. You can never really tell if a book is going to do well or do terribly. Publishers themselves have no clue. but Mammoth ended up being the best-selling fiction title for my publisher, UQP, in 2020.
Oh, that's incredible. Congratulations.
Yeah, to everyone's sort of shock, mine included. So it found a very wide audience. And when we looked at we broke down the statistics of where people were buying it, a huge number of people in regional and suburban areas, not so much the inner city types. So that was interesting too. And anyway, it seemed to have a bit of a wide appeal. I did a lot of media around it because there was so much to talk about in terms of genetics and paleontology and so on. And then just over a year ago, it would have been March last year, so mid-pandemic really, I get an email out of the blue from the head of exhibitions at Museums of Victoria. And I'd never heard of him. I don't know how he got my email, actually. And he wanted me to come in for a meeting. They had a project to discuss. And it hadn't occurred to me at the time, but of course, Mammoth had been read by all the people in the museum because it's their world, you know? And so we were in that brief, brief periods when Victorians were allowed to leave their homes. And so I went into Melbourne Museum for a meeting, not knowing what it was about. And surrounded by people in this boardroom table, all grinning at me because they'd all read Mammoth. And I thought, oh, they've just dragged me in just to have a look at me. But then they told me that Melbourne Museum had acquired a Triceratops. And it was in the process of being cleaned the specimen in Vancouver Island, just off the coast of Canada, and was going to be transported to Melbourne and would be exhibited there permanently at Melbourne Museum. Now, the extraordinary thing about it is that it is the most complete specimen of Triceratops that has ever been found, in that it is 87% complete, and the skull and the horns and the beak, the teeth, 99% complete. Complete tail, complete vertebrae, and nothing like it's ever been discovered by science. And amazingly,
sorry, Chris, where was this one from?
Right, so this was found in 2014 in Montana,
okay,
in the Hell Creek Formation, which is sort of well known for fossils, by a individual prospector called Craig Pfister, who has a little paleontology business called Great Plains Paleontology. And he goes out looking for specimens, often by himself in the wilderness. And Hell Creek Formation in Montana is just this vast, empty, foreboding looking place of canyons and ravines and, you know, just wilderness. It's not easy, you know, to even camp out there. And it's private property, and he had got a permit to go and prospect for dinosaur bones. And he had found something sticking out of the rock. And when he cleaned it off, it was an entire Triceratops lying on its side. And it's 67 million years old. So it died probably about 2 million years before the meteor came and wiped everything out. So it was already fossilized by then. But we reckon what happened was that it had been drinking down by the river and fallen in and drowned because they couldn't swim, and lay on its side on the riverbed and was covered in river sediment, wasn't really affected by predators, and just lay there on its side for 67 million years, and wow. So was virtually undisturbed. There are hardly any bones missing.
This was, Chris, this was something that struck me a few years ago. I was in LA and went to the La Brea Tar Pits. I don't know if you've ever been there, but growing up in the US, that was like canonical, is, you know, you talk about the La Brea Tar Pits. And I always wondered why the animals would have fallen in, because, like, obviously it's a big pit of like bubbling mud and tar. But when I went, and it struck me, of course, like the water pools on top, so it just looks like a pool of water, and so of course they would have gone in to sort of, you know, cool off or have a drink or whatever they do, and then got stuck there. But that was kind of a revolution for me when I
went there. They're also very, you know, large, clumsy creatures. And there's so much we don't know about particularly late Cretaceous era dinosaurs and when which Triceratops lived. And we're learning a lot from this particular specimen. It was just fortunate, really, that it was 2014 when he found it. And at the time, the state government here in Victoria were interested in acquiring something big for the museum, a specimen of a dinosaur, because, you know, it's a bit awkward to discuss this, but a lot of dinosaurs in museums are not actually real. They're replicas, or they might only be 12% real, you know, because they've only got a couple of bones. It's actually very difficult to find a complete specimen. And most, you know, fairly complete looking specimens in museums are actually composites of several different animals cobbled together. So to find a complete one, they heard this guy had found it. They flew our head paleontologist, Eric Fitzgerald, out there, and it was acquired for $3 million before it ever made the open market, which is just as well, because these things go for a lot of money in the open market. And if it had gone to auction, it probably would have wound up bought by a much more, you know, powerful entity. A major museum or a private collector, which is
exactly
what I had discussed in Mammoth about the idea of private collectors acquiring dinosaur bones for their own aggrandizement, you know, self-aggrandizement. So we avoided that fate, and then it had to be cleaned in Canada by a team called Dynolab, who specialize in cleaning the field jacket away from the fossilized bones. So the bones are essentially excavated in the rock, and then the rock's slowly cleaned away.
Using acid, or how do they, or like little brushes, like on TV?
Yes, they're excavated using tiny little brushes and almost like surgical instruments and scalpels. It's very, very painstaking. And then prepared and then delivered to museums around the world. And these guys have kind of wound up inadvertently being the foremost world's experts in cleaning and preparing dinosaur fossils for museums. And they also build the steel structures that support dinosaurs in museum spaces. So we no longer, you know, screw things into the fossilized bones. They are suspended. They're sort of hanging free, really, in this huge steel armature that was hand welded by some former oil and gas pipeline guys who work in Canada and who now find themselves being the world's foremost dinosaur levitation experts. And so they built this sort of phantom triceratops for us out of steel. And then you put the bones into the steel structure and just set them in there, so that then they can be taken out individually for study. Or they also use extremely powerful tiny magnets for smaller specimens. So I've seen images of some of the tiny little oviraptors and so on that they've prepared, where it seems impossible what they've done, because the specimen is sort of hovering with all its bones in opposition to each other, in magnetic opposition to each other. They use tiny magnets that attach to each bone, so it looks like it's being held up by nothing.
That's incredible.
So that was the, and then it had to be transported to Melbourne and prepared and then reassembled out of crates, which the person who had to do that described it as the strangest IKEA furniture of all time.
And our dinosaur, do you know, are dinosaur bones heavy, or are they lighter than mammal? Okay, they're super heavy.
They're very heavy and very fragile and slightly radioactive.
Really?
Yes, because of the radiation actually is slightly beneficial to the preservation of fossils. It keeps
bacteria and...
Yeah, it does.
Fungus and stuff away.
Yeah, it does. And so fossils in Mongolia and in parts of America, when they're found, they are slightly radioactive. So they have to be handled very carefully, and people can't be exposed to them for too long until that's cleaned. So it's quite a task, really, reassembling a dinosaur from scratch. And I was brought in on the strength of Mammoth. They realized that they were going to have to produce some books about this Triceratops. Yep. And it is very, you know, fashionable, if you like, in museums around the world to anthropomorphize their collections. And I had already done that with Mammoth. And so they wanted me to do the same with Horridus, as this specimen is called, because the full Latin name is Triceratops horridus. They had a internal competition to decide on the name, and there were, I think, 1,000 names on the long list. So it was, some of them were ridiculous, you know. Jeff and
Jeff.
And Horny McHornface, you know, that's sort of ridiculous ideas. So Horridus was eventually chosen. And so my job was all of a sudden to help produce, was to write a kid's book, the first in a series of kid's books featuring Horridus back in the Cretaceous, to create a character and voice for Horridus that can be used in the books, but also perhaps later on social media, because a lot of fossil specimens in museums have their own Twitter accounts, such as Sue the T-Rex in the Field Museum in Chicago. So that might be something that Horridus will do. I've written a whole style guide for that. And then the big coffee table book that they wanted something pretty that would convey what had happened. And so this book has photographs from the dig site, from the preparation lab in Canada, from transportation to behind the scenes at Melbourne Museum last year, during the pandemic when everyone was working like maniacs in there to build this dinosaur. Because initially it was supposed to open towards the end of last year and it was an insanely tight deadline, but it got delayed. The pandemic sort of did us a bit of a favor. And it opened in March this year. And there's been thousands of people coming through every day to look at this specimen, which is for many people quite an emotional experience, we've found. Mm-hmm. We had already anecdotally heard that, you know, people working with the specimen whilst it was being cleaned and prepared were having quite unusual reactions to spending time with it. And it sort of goes into kind of slightly esoteric territory, but welder who spent, his name's Rye Williams, he spent I think 3 months alone with the skull, the huge intact skull of the Triceratops in his shed whilst he created a steel structure that could support it, you know, the huge frill and the horns and everything. And every day, it was a pandemic obviously there too, and so in Canada, so every day he would just be alone with it. He said that he could hear it talk.
Wow.
So it was no shock to him when I said that I was giving it a voice. He said, oh, well, that'll be easy because you spend enough time with it and you'll hear it.
That's so interesting. Did you feel that? Did you hear a clear voice with this creature?
There's no doubt when you spend time with it, if you get a chance next time you're in Melbourne to come in, it's quite an unexpectedly powerful experience when you see it, because it is a virtually complete dinosaur that is a beautiful sort of dark chocolate brown color, which is quite unusual and different to the specimens you usually see mounted in museums, which are very sort of bleached white bone looking.
What is that difference because of? What's caused that?
They reckon it, I mean, that's the natural color of it, but they reckon that it's because of the river sediment in which it died, that the sediment would have basically sunk into the bones and it absorbed them. So it's just a beautiful color. And I mean, I've been with people who've burst into tears when they've seen it. Just overwhelmed by the emotion of seeing something that looked like it was alive a few months ago, when it's 67 million years old. And so it sort of speaks to this almost inconceivable human notion of deep time, because I mean, we're very young. We've only been on the Earth for a very, very brief moment, tens of thousands of years. These creatures walked the Earth for over 100 million years, just going about their business. This thing died 67 million years ago and is still here. So it's almost a disturbing experience to see it. As I almost said, in the flesh, but because it feels very real. It really brings it home that this was a real creature that walked the earth for its kind, walked the earth for millions and millions of years before, long, long before we were ever here. And they're all gone. Mm. And we've been here a very short space of time and have managed to make quite a mess of things in a very brief period.
Yes, we have. And so the voice that you have, you sort of captured that voice in the books that you worked on, or is it with the materials that go along with the exhibition, or
no, it's all of those? It's more in the books where I had to think about. I mean, I've got a strange process with this stuff anyway, where I do quite enjoy imagining the world through the eyes of non-human entities.
Which is one of the things we love about you. Please don't ever stop that.
Well, I have not stopped it, because my next book for adults the sort of sequel to Mammoth, if you like, comes out in September and is called Here Be Leviathans, and is I hesitate to say short stories because they're very long. Stories from the points of view of animals and other non-living entities. So we've got a grizzly bear who eats the brain of a teenager during a fun run and absorbs his memories. We've got a rhesus macaque monkey test pilot in the 1950s, based on a true story about Albert Six, the first monkey to make it into space and get back alive. And we've got a saber-toothed tiger, because that was pretty hard on those in Mammoth. So so one of those
redemption
gets a story.
Story
of his own in a futuristic theme park where he's been cloned back to life. But also some other more unexpected beings, if you like. A hotel room is a narrator of one story. An airline
pre-COVID,
seat.
Post-COVID or during COVID?
It's sort of ignoring COVID.
Okay.
The hotel room. There's an airline seat talking about its, which is a sort of a workplace story. There's a yacht. So this sort of thing is obviously right up my alley. So it made sense that I'd be the one to try and bring a voice to Horridus, which was kind of fun. It's a bit strange trying to imagine how a Cretaceous creature might talk.
With a relatively small brain as well, right?
I was just about to say, one of the things that has helped me has been access. This time around has been, I have access to all the science I could ever require because I have a desk at Melbourne Museum, and the paleontologists helped me navigate creating a voice for Horridus and creating these books about Horridus. The kids' book, unusually for a children's book, has been checked thoroughly by the paleontologists to make sure all of the flora and fauna in the book are actually what would appear in the Cretaceous era. We're trying not to have any, I mean, obviously they're talking, so, you know, it's not completely accurate, but we try to have as few anachronisms as possible. And
that's going to appeal to all those these kids out there who know those facts and have been pretty upset at the lack of quality control so far.
You're totally right. There's actually been studies undertaken that show that the world's foremost dinosaur experts are aged 5 to 12.
Mm.
Because that's the time in your life when you know more about dinosaurs than the adult. And it gives kids a sense of agency to know something more than their parents. And then after age 12, it sort of tapers off, and then people don't become dinosaur experts again unless they move into paleontology.
Yeah. What do you think it is about dinosaurs that draws kids?
It's that sort of here be dragons thing, I think, you know, this idea of monsters that walk the earth, even though some of them wouldn't have done you any harm, probably.
Not intentionally, anyway.
Not intentionally. I mean, you mentioned the brain of Triceratops, and we never knew what the brain looked like before, but now we do because of this specimen. Because the head was completely intact, we were able to do every single part of it has been scanned, and we have full 3D images of everything, including the brain cavity. So we had an intact brain cavity. So we were able to work out the shape of the brain. And it is it's probably about the length of your forearm, the brain, and almost the shape of your forearm. It's sort of long,
really,
almost cylindrical, strange looking shape. Very small for such a large creature.
Yeah.
And we've done, we've 3D printed for the exhibition a lot of the pieces that would be missing, so you can actually see the brain and sort of hold it in your hands. That sort of stuff is incredible. There's so much we're learning from the specimen. I interviewed for the Coffee Table Book scientists and paleontologists and people from all walks of life all over the world for the book. And one of the people I interviewed was Dr. Susanna Maidment at the Natural History Museum in London. Mm-hmm. And she's great, Susie, and she's an expert in dinosaur locomotion. And so she was fascinated to see the scans of the feet and the legs, because she has a theory that looks like it's being proven for the first time ever, that Triceratops could not run, which is contrary to how we imagine them from movies, where they're, you know, almost like a stampeding herd of rhinos. Mm-hmm. No, probably false, because they would have been way too front heavy. The skull, the horns, these things are enormous, very heavy, and they would easily, if they'd started running, just bowled over. So they reckon that they were a very sedentary animal, in actual fact, and moved quite slowly and relied on, and because they moved slowly, they needed that huge frill for defense, because they did live at the same time as tyrannosaurs.
Of course.
And there have been tyrannosaur specimens discovered that have cylindrical holes in their rib, in their ribs, where they obviously would have been punctured by the horns of a triceratops. Wow. And triceratops with bite marks on their frill. But they would have gone after each other, but it would have, and that's the classic dino fight, triceratops versus T-Rex. But in actual fact, it probably wouldn't have happened very often, because hugely risky for both creatures to take each other on. It's the ultimate offense versus the ultimate defense, and it's probably going to end badly for both parties.
So they would have been, it would have been an echidna-like strategy, like a hunker down and like stick your horns out to keep.
And of course, the horns and the frill were actually made of keratin.
So like fingernail.
So they were actually covered in a layer of keratin. So. We think that the frills of Triceratops might have been quite brightly colored with hair. And that's not really ever been conveyed in images that we've seen in books and movies over the years.
No.
Either. They're sort of usually portrayed as sort of a dull brown, sort of tan color.
Yeah.
But they might have been quite brightly colored. Exactly. But those frills were probably used for defense and for attracting a mate. So they probably would have been quite brightly colored.
Wow.
So that's. Yes, so all these things we're discovering from the specimen. There's still a lot to learn.
Yes. And have you found that, because you write, one of the characteristics of your writing is that you're quite funny. Like, have you felt that you've had to shift working with the museum, or are you still able to get humor through in the
work? Yes, it's the old, you know, it's like the T-Rex versus the Triceratops, who's going to win? It's not that I'm, you know, trying to bend the museum to my will, but but they did hire me because of who I am. Mm. And so they knew what they were getting. And so there is, you know, quite a bit of humor in the kids' books, and everyone seems to enjoy that. And the style guide that I wrote for Hordas's personality, which we were going to roll out on social media when the exhibition opened, but we decided to, you know, hang back on that for a bit. It's not that easy creating a, you know, social media identity just from scratch. But in the style guide for that, I had to go through all the do's and don'ts, things that Hordas would like and wouldn't like. And that was quite good fun. Hordas, for example, because they're from Montana, a big fan of Jeff Bridges, because Jeff Bridges is also from Montana. Mm-hmm. And is of course a vegetarian, vegan, and quite interested in some of the vegan restaurants that we have in Melbourne. and is kind of a wise old creature, but also quite young and naive, because finds itself in our world and is quite curious as to what's going on. And one of the things I asked people in the interviews was for the coffee table book, even was, you know, what do you think Triceratops would make of our world today, and where would it live? You know, would it, how would it survive? And it was quite interesting hearing some of the responses. We reckon that if Triceratops were alive today, if it was possible to bring them back, which it is much more unlikely than mammoths or any megafauna, because they're extinct fairly recently, whereas this is a long time ago, getting viable DNA is virtually impossible. but they would probably live in tropical Queensland.
Really?
Yeah, because they were actually a rainforest animal. We also think of these dinosaurs as being plains animals, but they weren't really.
Is that because they're often found in the plains, and so we have a hard time imagining what it would have been like?
I mean, probably if you dug up some rainforest, which you wouldn't want to do, but you'd probably find some dinosaur fossils underneath there. They lived in a very sort of humid climate, and we reckon that Triceratops just lived quietly in the rainforest, and would have just moved slowly through, ate a lot of vegetation, ferns and cycads that are still around today, or modern versions of them, and used its teeth to sort of use its beak to shear off pieces of vegetation, and then its grinders to sort of chew it up. This specimen that we found actually had fossilized stomach contents, which has never been found before. So we were able look at those too. So it's sort of nice to think of them as being different to how we imagined, more brightly colored perhaps, and living in a slightly different environment to how we imagined them living. And it just goes to show, we think, you know, science is having to completely reinvent itself all the time in terms of what we learn and what we know and what we don't know, and be willing to look at new evidence.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that we, you know, even when, you know, you're hanging out with scientists or you're trained in science, you forget that we don't know. We hardly know anything about these animals. And And so that's so exciting, everything that you've been learning. Can I go back to you were talking about your next book, We Be Leviathans?
Here Be Leviathans.
Here Be Leviathans. now I'm very curious, because you do often take characters from interesting real life stories or interesting locations that in ways that not a lot of other writers do the way you do. How does an object acquire character status for you? What elevates it to that stage?
I mean, I was just reading the final proofs of the book, because it's about to go to print, and I have written a quite lengthy afterword in which I explain the context of each story in the collection. So hopefully that will be kind of eye-opening and fun for people to realize that some of these unlikely stories may well be based on something that really happened, or the places in the story actually exist. And the process of something coming alive for me, I think it's through my interaction with it. The hotel room story, for example, where the hotel room narrates the tale and is about a couple who go to a hotel room on their honeymoon and then go back there every few years to that same room. And so the room has an unusual opportunity of being able to see the same people over and over again, and it tries to help them because they're trying to conceive a child and struggling. So it sort of tries to be the best version of itself to help them, and ends up
dimming the lights, putting on the James Brown, et cetera.
Well, essentially, you know, it winds up, you know, being a parent of sorts to the child, and mother kind of acknowledges that. And that sort of story came about because I weirdly was placed in the same hotel room 5 years apart by the Adelaide Writers Festival. And it freaked me out at the time to realize I was in exactly the same room. But then I really started to think about everything that had gone on in that room since I was there last, all the people who'd come through, the stories of their lives. And then I started to think about, oh, what would this room tell me if it, you know, of all the things it's seen, the human behavior that it's witnessed in the last 5 years, the types of people.
What story would stand out for the room?
That's right. And in the story, the room does mention some of the memorable moments in its time, as does the airline seat, which is a similar sort of themed story. So I guess I just kind of like that. Maybe it's because I'm in this world of deep time now, whether I like it or not, of thinking about things from the long distant past and why they're still with us and what it means for them to remain. That I find myself in this mindset of almost being able to easily jump outside of the now and the present and the very limiting three score year and 10 that the Bible says that we will have as humans, although it's got a bit longer now, probably life expectancy, but you know, not many people live to their 100, I suppose. Yeah. Probably more so nowadays. But a friend of mine recently was saying his friend's mother is 98 and she's hanging on and hanging on, but she's just hanging on until she's 100. And then he said she'll probably die because that tends to be what happens. People are, they just want to reach that milestone and then they're like, that's it. And they just off they go. So that's a very small period of time we have on Earth. So it's just kind of a fascinating obsession for me to think about it in larger terms and stepping back. And even though we may only live for say 100 years, there are the desk I'm sitting at, I don't know how old it is, but it's pretty old and it's probably going to live longer than me. So there's lots of everyday objects around us that never go away. And as humans, we're very good at creating things that last forever, unfortunately. The ocean's full of stuff that's going to take quite a long time to break down. But I don't know. I have this curiosity about what they think of us. And so I just have a natural tendency to ascribe personality to animals. And animals is a bit easier probably than objects, but it's just an ongoing fascination of mine, I think.
I think I've become more interested in kind of this, what is the scale of a lifetime as I've gotten older myself, and obviously like I'm tipping into the sort of the last half of that. and I think that's something that fiction does so brilliantly. I don't know if you read Circe by Madeline Miller.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes, but that's like, it's like the scale of a lifetime of a Titan that lives for this incredibly long period. And you still feel like, oh, but it's such a short time. Like it all fit within this book. And we've spoken before about Elizabeth Gilbert's The Signature of All Things. Like,
yes.
Again, it's an entire life that's just encapsulated on these pages. And to be able to...
I love those kind of books, you know. Another one that I read last year was Maggie Shipstead's Great Circle, which I was nominated for a bunch of awards and is quite different to a lot of the other award sort of bait books, in that it also just encapsulates the entire life of a woman who becomes one of the first female aviators. And that book was inspired by Maggie, who's a big traveler, seeing a statue of a female aviator in New Zealand and saying, who the hell's that?
Yeah.
And then just going off and writing a book about a woman who tries to circumnavigate the globe by plane, north to south, just to make it extra difficult for herself. But she covers her entire life. It's a big, thick book, but it's very satisfying.
Yeah, and I think...
But the thing about those... I was going to say that the thing about those long-term stories, you know, the idea of a titan that lives for a very long time, or, you know, a human that lives 100 years or more, is that it doesn't matter how long you have, you'll always sort of go to your grave with regrets about the things that you didn't do, right? So even if you live for 700 years, you'd probably be like, damn it, I still never got around to learning German.
Yeah, I know. I know. It does. In a sense, it those kinds of books I find really, they give you that sort of double feeling of that satisfaction of, oh, that was a life. But also then, and you get to sort of also reflect outside that bound, because you know, you had your life before you read that life, and then you have your life after you read that life. So it's like it's set within a life, life within a life within a life. But then it's also like, you know, it's always going to be too short for us, isn't it? I mean, right. I want to.
Well, the thing I find really frustrating, one of my big frustrations has always been with fiction and with, you know, especially with movies, is that you're getting such a little glimpse into the person's life. It's never enough. And you wonder, you know, what happened to them, you know, in the months and years before that? What happened to them after that? You know, I guess forcibly, because, you know, books are only going to be a few hundred pages long, and movies are only going to be 2 hours. So you only can convey so much. But I always find that a little bit frustrating. And I think I've gravitated more as I've got older towards books like Liz Gilbert's Signature of All Things, or Maggie Shipstead's Great Circle, because I get more, or those sort of long form narrative TV shows where you get the multiple seasons of Better Call Saul or whatever, where you get to see everything that happened in Albuquerque in the lead up to Breaking Bad. You know, I find that much more satisfying from a narrative perspective. And it's definitely influencing my work, because I'm thinking a lot more. I mean, I tried to squeeze a lot of stuff into Mammoth, and it's probably to a degree unsatisfying. But the book I'm working on, which I've been mulling over for years, I'm trying to take a leaf out of the book of these books that I've been reading, and think a bit more deeply about, okay, I've got the central story. But rather than some pat backstory that's sort of tossed off in a paragraph, why don't I just have like these whole other sections that are set when that person's younger, and that have their own sort of, that could be their own standalone stories that will be satisfying in their own way, but which then just give you a much greater understanding of that character in the main story that you're reading. And so, I'm enjoying doing that, because suddenly a very specific novel can become lots of different things for you as the writer, because you're like, oh, wait a minute, I can actually fit in a murder story here as you know, that can be a backstory to this character as to why they wind up there. Ah, right, great, you know. So it's really opened up for me, and I'm enjoying embracing the everythingness of novels now.
I'm happy to hear that, because that's actually one of the struggles I've been having with my current novel, is that I do want to include some of the previous generations in one of the families that I'm focusing on, and I haven't figured out yet how to do that in a way that, so I can capture those stories in a way that builds the contemporary stories into something sort of bigger and more real feeling, I guess.
A good tip I would say is using the eras in which they're set. So if you want to bring in a previous generation, mm-hmm. who, and you might say, well, how old were they in 1925 or whatever, so, and where do they live? Okay, so what happened there during that time, you know, and then can you mix them up with those events of that time? And often, you know, just doing something can be arbitrary like that. You can uncover some little forgotten pocket of history, and that just perfectly to your purpose. And also then enables you to write that backstory and it be compelling for the reader, so that they're not just like, oh, this is boring backstory that's just setting up the main character. Suddenly it's a standalone thing that you can enjoy. A bit like, is it The Godfather 2, where it goes back to Marlon Brando's character when he's young. He's played by Robert De Niro, but he's got his own standalone story, you know. And I guess I just mentioned Better Call Saul, you know, which was Saul Goodman, the lawyer character in Breaking Bad, who now has six seasons of his own spin-off show, which is all, and you know what's going to happen to some of the characters because they don't appear in Breaking Bad, so they're probably going to get killed. But
I don't know if you've read Hilary St. John Mandel's newest books, but she's been doing this really interesting thing where at least my friend said that it's also there in Station 11, but in her other two, The Glass Hotel and Sea of Tranquility, there are crossover like times and characters. So you get like hints of that it's the same world and that she's just kind of dipped in different places and times into this same universe that's happening.
And I am very interested in that sort of technique. And I've been chatting to some writer friends about this lately. And you know, to a degree, the dumb old Marvel cinematic universe, in which everything appears in the same universe, is kind of a useful conceit for a writer because you can create your own, you know, literary universe in which everything is happening. And I've tried to do that. Essentially, these stories in my new book all exist in the same universe as Mammoth.
Great.
And the new novel I'm working on also exists in that universe. So there will be references to some of the characters in Mammoth in my new book. And some of the characters might even be related.
Great.
And I love that.
Because I find that so satisfying as a reader. To be like, oh, it's that shock of like, I know that, like, you know, and it kind of, I don't know, it reminds you of the previous book and then extends it in a new way. And it's really lovely feeling.
Well, there's also the Irish writer, Sebastian Barry does it. I had to interview Sebastian Barry at the Adelaide Writers Festival. I was so excited to interview him. He had just had his book all about them. What was it called? Days of something. God, I've got it sitting there. Days Without End, which is his book set during the American Civil War. And I loved that. And I was like, oh, I can't believe I'm going to get to interview Sebastian Barry. But I had to interview Sebastian Barry and another American writer, Jane. Oh, God, I've forgotten her surname now. I shouldn't remember it because she tortured me. the idea, and they really dumped it on me, Adelaide, was that I had to interview them about their body of work.
Easy.
So I had to, I know. Well, because in Sebastian Barry's novels, it turns out that he uses the same surname for all of his characters, even though they're set in different eras. So they're all part of the same family. Right. Over several hundred years, these are their descendants in different stories. And the other writer had done the same, written these three epic novels that are all following the same family and their descendants and their ancestors. Oh my God. So I had to read all of these to try and make sense of it. And then a week before the festival, Sebastian Barry pulled out due to personal reasons. And then on the day of the event, the American writer, she didn't turn up. She fell asleep in the park.
did you cancel the event or did you get up there and talk yourself about...
because there was a young Canadian writer who'd written two books from the point of view of the same family, and he was a last minute sort of stand-in for Sebastian Barry, so his name wasn't even on the program, and so I had to go on stage with him. He didn't want to go, but I had to drag him up there and say we have to do something. And then explained to the large crowd in the gardens that Sebastian Barry was not there, but the other writer, she wasn't there either.
But we have this person.
We have this guy, and we're going to try and talk for an hour. And I had to just throw all my questions away because they were useless. We had to sort of wing it, and I'd had like 2 days to read his book, so I just had to improvise on the spur of the moment. But reading all those Sebastian Barry books and realizing oh, okay, there's connections here. You know, some of these characters, they mention a character from one of his other books because they're related to them.
Mm.
And so that was the first time I had seen that. And having to read 6 or 7 books in succession, all from the same author. And so unusually being acutely aware that he was doing it then was quite a useful exercise for me, because then it made me think about, oh, okay, you can do this. It's a thing you can do, and not everyone's going to notice necessarily, but the eagle-eyed readers will notice, and you can probably, you know, talk about it when you're doing interviews. So that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, I like that. And it also, because I know a lot of times people are like, oh, so like your next book, is it a sequel? And you're like, no. It's... But, you know, and then it, in a sense, if it is, kind of, but not really a sequel.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the novel I'm working on could technically be called a sequel to Mammoth, but it's not. Mm. It's set in 1935.
Meanwhile, maybe.
Yeah. It's got lots of references to Mammoth in it, but Mammoth set in 2007 primarily, and this one's set in 1935. So, but it's in that same realm.
Oh, that's really, I think that's a good place for us to wind up today, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us on Science Right Now.
It's my pleasure as always. I suppose I'm one of those unusual writers who's doing fun books about with a science basis in them, which is a bit of a niche genre perhaps, but it is quite a good genre to be working in, you know, fiction with a sort of scientific basis, because it gives you lots to talk about. And one of the things I've learned is that as an author, if you're going to be asked to do festivals and interviews, you need to have some stuff to talk about. and if you've just completely imagined everything, then it can be tricky. And one of the things that made me aware of that was a few years ago, I went to Melbourne Writers Festival just to sit in the audience and watch Camilla Shamsi, who's the sort of Pakistani English author, and she had a book out called Burnt Leaves, which was quite successful, and she had a big crowd, and the book was partially set in Japan in the aftermath of the Americans dropping the A-bomb, and it was a bit of burns victim, you know, in the aftermath of that. Beautifully written and very well researched, except the event went great, except at the very end, an audience member said to her, "How long did you spend in Japan?" And she just, quick as you like, said, "Oh, I've never been to Japan." And the audience went, "Oh!" There's a collective like gasp of like shock. And she realized what she'd said. She goes, "Oh, but you don't have to go in order to write a book about it. You know, I spent a long time researching it," but she'd lost them.
Yes.
Because then they were like, "Oh, she just made all this up. Oh, that's no good." And everyone walked out at the end, and hardly anyone came to the signing table.
Oh.
And in the audience, I thought, okay, and you do have to be careful about this stuff. People want to believe in what you're writing, and so you have to make sure that what you're doing is grounded in reality for people to have something to cling on to in fiction. There needs to be some hooks for them to be able to feel like they can access it. And whilst, you know, fiction is the realm of the imagination, I think having some real world things in there can go a long way to helping readers identify with the book and helping you as the author to promote it.
Absolutely. No, I agree with that 100%. I mean, my next book is, it has some bits set in Korea and some bits set in Sweden and Denmark. Mm. And because I started writing it just before COVID, basically, obviously haven't been to either place in the last couple of years. So I've basically got my research to the point where I feel like I just have to go and be there and smell the smells of the food and like just walk down the street and hear what the birds sound like and just all of those little details that you can't get on Google Street View or in documents. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's that immersion in the reality of it can really help you as a creative to suddenly make connections in your mind and come up with a very rich rich prose that really conveys what the place is actually like. I mean, this book I have coming out, I'm quite looking forward to the idea that, you know, because it's stories, people will scoff and say, oh yeah, I like some stories, don't like other stories. You can almost write the reviews in advance. And some stories people will probably be like, no, I didn't really like that one. But then I'm hoping that when they get to the end and read the context, that might make them change their mind about some of the stories that they didn't like when they see that, you know, the reason why it was actually created and what it was and who those people actually were. So that would be interesting to see if people get to the end and then suddenly decide they like the book when they read the afterword.
Yes. You have to put in some little like, don't stop now, like bookmarks. Get to the end.
Yeah, I'll have to point this out when I'm doing media and say, you know, if you don't like the stories, just skip to the end bit and read the reason why I wrote it, and maybe it'll make you think differently about it.
Yeah, and then maybe go back and try again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm quite happy for people to jump around in a book of stories and to skip to the if they know the explanation's there, then you might as well, you know, let them skip to it. And I've learned from Mammoth, everyone enjoyed the afterword, in which everything that's just happened is explained to you as to how much of it is real and how much of it is made up. And people really loved that. And I was asked so many questions because of that. And it has made me realize, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had when you're making something up. The incidental research you're doing as you're going along, whether it's just, you know, Googling a place and finding out some little details about what stone the buildings are made from or something like that. You know, when you explain that afterwards, people like that stuff. So it's worthwhile throwing it in there, I think.
Yeah. And what is it, do you think, about having those tethers to reality? Like, because we all know fiction is not true, but also true simultaneously. But what is it about knowing that which elements are true and which ones aren't that makes a difference for readers, do you think?
I think in recent years in particular, you know, quote unquote, literature has moved very, very far away from the world of the imagination, moved much more towards realism and, you know, personal narratives. And you only have to walk into a bookstore and look and see what's on sale. And there's a lot of memoir and a lot of personal stories. And it's sort of expected almost that authors are speaking from personal experience somehow, that you must be in there somewhere, or this must have happened to you. And people are slightly disappointed when you say it didn't happen to you and it's not your story. I think, you know, there's always a bit of confusion around how the creative mind works. And, you know, this is why there's so many workshops and, you know, courses to explain to you how to be a writer. But yeah, good luck. As we said before, there are a million ways to do it. And all of them valid and none necessarily better than any other way. And that's frustrating, maybe, if you just want a set of rules to follow. But I think sometimes the creative mind scares people a little bit because they don't understand it. And certainly I've had people look at me with suspicious eyes because they think, well, how are you doing this? Where is this coming from? Like, I don't know. I can't explain it myself, but, and people want it to be quantified. And so I think having my concession to that is having quantifiable, verifiable items in my fiction that mean people can be satisfied, say, oh yes, okay, this, yeah. this is about those monkeys that they were shooting up in rockets in 1950s in America. Yep, I remember reading about that. Oh, mm-hmm. my God, except it's told from the point of view of the monkey, mm-hmm. Who is a, you know, dead set, the right stuff astronaut, who's like, I'm going to complete this mission, you know, even though all my predecessors have crashed and burned, I'm going to be the one who does it.
played by Tom Cruise in the film.
if Tom reads this story, he'll probably want it rewritten with himself in the lead. Yes, I
think. Oh, well, that's great. We could just keep talking forever, Chris. But I
this is actually a work day for me, so I do need to get back to
work. Yes, I will let you get back to your work. Thank you very much for joining us, Chris.
That's my pleasure. Anytime.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider sharing or leaving us a review. It really helps young podcasts like ours reach more listeners. We love to hear from you on email, Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. And you can find more writers and writing inspired by science on our website, scienceRightNow.com. Science Right Now is sponsored by the Australia Council for the Arts, hosted by Amanda Niehaus and Jessica White, and produced by Taylor Mitchell. Thanks so much for listening.